Good to see all of you this evening. It's always a pleasure. As I had mentioned at the beginning of the year, my hope was is that when we finished Isaiah, we would embark on a study in the evenings on the book of John. And I want you to know that that's not just, well, let me see, what should we do? That was not it at all. I've been wanting to do this for quite some time because of the relevance that John's gospel has for us today. It's quite different, as most of you know, from the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and it has a very unique place in the gospel accounts and in the New Testament. I would generally, if you had asked me, and well, you can still ask me that today, I would say that the Gospel of John is probably one of the top three difficult books in the New Testament, and that's always something that I never would have thought I would have said when I was first studying the Bible, because I would have just said, well, you know, there's just some simple stories there, and that's just about all there is to it, until about 15, 17, 18 years ago, something like that. Good brother in Florida, David McClister, just casually mentioned that there was a connection to the signs and the festivals and all kinds of things to the Old Testament. And I remember Brent and I sitting next to each other, and we dropped our computer practically, looked at each other and went, oh boy, we got a lot of work to do. And for the next 3 years, we immersed ourselves together in the Gospel of John and have studied it quite a bit even ever since then. So I want to share a lot of those things with you especially, but to see this gospel, it will mean a lot to our daily lives. And that may be surprising to you, but that's what I want to show you tonight. So we're going to look at an overview, a message, primary message, but especially spend the last part of our time in looking at the relevance that the gospel has for us today. Let me just place before you just a four-part thing that we'll look at tonight. We're first going to just look at John's purpose and his use of signs, try to see why he uses these signs first and foremost so that we're aware of them. Secondly, we want to look at just briefly at the unique structure John has that's different than the other gospel accounts. So the other gospel accounts are quite similar in a lot of ways. And then we'll look also at John's presentation of Jesus as the Word. Again, don't want to spend too much. We could spend a lot of time on it. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but simply give you an idea of why that's so significant, of him referring then to Jesus as the Word as he begins his gospel. And then finally, as mentioned, we will look at the relevance of John's gospel today. And that to me is one of the things that's most exciting, is to see how important his message is for us today. Our general thought is, well, isn't John's purpose just to show us that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? Isn't that really his purpose? Well, actually, John tells us that. That's right. So at the very end of the book, John makes this statement when he says, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Now, on the surface, you just look at that and you say, well, isn't that what all the Gospels are doing? Not in the way John is doing it, and not for the reason John is doing it. And we're going to parse out some of these things tonight because I want you to see how these words are, how John connects these words and how John shows this purpose and a purpose that is not exactly immediately evident in our English, most of our English translations just from that particular verse. So certainly all the gospel accounts tell us about Jesus being the Christ. But when we look at Matthew through Luke, what we're mainly seeing is presentations of Jesus as a human being living an earthly life. As a matter of fact, where do they all begin? Well, they all begin with Jesus either at his birth, like in Matthew and Luke, or like in Mark, just with his ministry. This is just something, this is how it starts. And yet, where does John start? Well, he starts before the beginning. If you say in the beginning was the Word, then the Word was always there, just like in the beginning God, so God was always there. And so John wants to start way back before all of these things and bring us into understanding something unique about Jesus, and therefore mainly an interpretation of Jesus, of who he really is, what his true nature is before us. And so it's the contrast between the synoptic gospels, where you have the greatness of Jesus' humanity and his perfection, what he does in his redemptive life on earth, as opposed to John's account, which is going to show us then a picture of his real person, who he actually is. And everything that you're going to see in the Gospel of John is pointing to his divinity and how that fits with the God that we would read about in the Old Testament, and in many cases were maybe just unaware that the Word was present, the Word was there. And so much of that is important for us to see. So as we have mentioned, John's account revolves around signs. So John doesn't use that word miracle. He talks about signs over and over again, because he wants to convey his message that way. He wants to convey a message in sign. Now, if I ask you, what other book did John write in which he conveys the message with signs? You would automatically know, wouldn't you? You'd say, well, that'd be the book of Revelation. Well, exactly. And so the Gospel of John, that's why I said, if you want to ask me what some of the hardest books in the New Testament, you know, we'd all say, well, I think Revelation's up there. Yeah, well, I think John's up there too, because both use signs. And we have to kind of figure out the code, so to speak. We have to see what is actually behind the sign, what is the actual message of the sign, before we can really get the idea of what is going on. So John only does 7 signs, or miracles, as we would call them in other passages. He just does 7. He just quotes 7 of Jesus' signs. Now, that's pretty unique when you realize what the synoptics do. So in the synoptic counts, Matthew has 16 miracles, Mark has 22 miracles, Luke has 20 miracles, and here is John, where his whole book is about signs, and he has 7. And John is picking carefully then, isn't he? Because John, even, we just read, John said, oh, in fact, the very end, John just says, if I wrote everything down that he ever did and all the signs he ever did, why, the world couldn't hold the book. We just like sometimes we sing that song where there wouldn't be enough ink to write it all and to say it all. And yet John only picks out 7 signs. Now, that's excluding Jesus' resurrection, which you would say is the climactic 8th sign, so to speak, which Jesus, of course, will accomplish when he raises from the dead. So only these 7 signs, but I want you to notice carefully, as I have on the screen here, these signs are specially picked to connect Jesus to being God in the Old Testament. So what he wants us to see is that when you're reading about Jesus in the Gospel of John, you're not reading about an earthly man. You're reading about a divine person who's always been, and he's going to always draw us and drive us back to that particular point. So we always want to see him as the one who is the God of the Old Testament that we always thought we were reading, that was just this one person we would call the Father. And that's something that's really unique, and it was very unique for the Jews. They would not have looked at it that way or seen it that way. Obviously, when you think about the word sign, so very, very, very important, think about the word sign. I know some of you, this is old hat, you understand this, but some may not. So a sign is always something that is giving a message or a lesson beyond what is obvious. Just like if you're reading Revelation and you see that the dragon has 7 heads and 10 horns and diadems on his heads, You're not supposed to draw a picture of it, even though I love to see Elizabeth draw pictures of it when that happens. But between Elizabeth and Jason Hill, they always like to illustrate my sermons with pictures, and I couldn't wait to see them later. But that's not the only thing you're doing. What are you doing? You're actually seeing something beyond that. Well, if he has seven heads, then, boy, he must be really intelligent. If he has diadems on his heads, he must be really, really powerful. And so you're seeing things like that. So that's the same thing you want to see when you're looking at the signs in the Gospel of John. There's a message beyond it. Do you happen to remember in Exodus chapter 3 and 4, specifically Exodus 4, when God gave Moses a sign? Remember what that sign was? He took his staff and threw it down, became a serpent, etc. Then he put his hand in his coat and brought it back out and was leprous. And God actually said, if they don't listen, hear these words, it's especially written this way in the King James, if they don't listen to the voice of the first sign, they will hear the voice of the second. Notice how he used that word? The voice of. And so that's what a sign, there's a voice there that you want to see. I used to read John, and I sure most of us did, where you just read about feeding the 5,000, you go, wow, he fed the 5,000. That's pretty cool. He used the kids' lunch. And you go on. Oh, man, John, if we had got to heaven without knowing deeper than that, John would have whooped us all. He'd had to say, I don't know, you may go back to purgatory or something. Well, I guess we don't have that, do we? But we might have been in danger. We have to understand his message that goes beyond. So we want to see those things. And just to give you an illustration of this, take a look at John 6:26. I have on the screen here. Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Now, Jesus, are you suggesting that these people didn't notice that you did a miracle and that you fed 5,000 with five loaves and two fish? Oh, no, I'm not suggesting that at all. They saw that perfectly well. In fact, they saw it so well that they showed up the next morning for breakfast. That's the case. What you didn't see, he's telling them, is you didn't see the sign. I'm showing you something that I'm the bread of life, and you never saw it. And there's other things he was showing through it too, but that was his emphasis. And I can tell you, it's not always just as simple as, oh, you're the bread of life, and that's always to be seen. You're going to see a whole lot more when we get to chapter 6 in that story, that sign that was given that he wants us to see then. So there's the ultimate purpose there. So there's another connection you want to make. You want to make connection with the signs and Jewish festivals. So it so happens that the Gospel of John has four Passovers, Feast of Dedication, and Feast of Tabernacles, or booths, as the more modern version would say. And John will casually mention that. Some of you have heard me say that before, but John will, like before he has the feeding of the 5,000, John will say, the Feast of Passover was near. And that's all he says. Now, if we're a careful reader, we should have went, why did John say that? Well, why'd you even throw that in there? One of the things I had to whack myself for over and over again in early years and still do in studying the Bible is God isn't wasting inspiration paper. When he says something, your antenna ought to go up. You ought to stand up and, well, wait a minute. Why did he say that? And then, well, lo and behold, he does it again in chapter 7. Oh, it just so happens the Feast of Booths was at hand. And then he'll mention another Passover. You know, you're supposed to immediately go, wait a minute. That should call me back to the original Passover and all the meanings that are going beyond this festival and connect the festival to Jesus the Messiah. Because he is now going to be a special fulfillment of that particular festival. This brings new meaning to us studying books like Leviticus or Deuteronomy, where we read about these festivals and read about what took place, because they weren't just, oh, something the Jews did. They were foreshadows. They were foreshadows of something greater in Jesus the Messiah. So that's the thing that we want to always keep in mind. Now, if we look at I'm going to call John 1, verse 11 through 13, the key verses of the book that sets it up. Technically, what you could do is you could take the first 18 verses of John, and you could say the entire book comes out of those 18 verses. Once you read those 18 verses, you're not going to read anything else in John that doesn't connect or isn't mentioned or introduced in those first 18 verses. I'll show you a little bit of that in just a moment. But 11 through 13 is really special. So check this out. He says in verse 11 about Jesus, he came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. Now, that is a key thematic statement that's going to be followed up through. Because what is happening? This is the beginning of John. You're being given the right. Those who receive him are given the right, the power, the authority to become children of God. How so? Because God is going to do that. He's going to birth you. Remember the story of Nicodemus. Suddenly we realize that at the end of the book, when he said, here's what I'm writing about, that you may have life in his name, the way you're going to have life in his name is because he's going to transform you. Born again, he will say in John 3. Suddenly you realize that all the way through the gospel, there is an emphasis on Jesus transforming things. His transforming power is always being given. And so you see this picture then of transformation. Water turned to wine, therefore want into abundance. A carnal temple foreshadowing a greater temple in Jesus. A timid Pharisaical ruler who is turned into a bold believer. A sinful Samaritan woman who becomes an evangel of the gospel. A Jesus transforming bread into an abundance so that mankind can have spiritual bread and always be filled and not hungry. Jesus calling on the thirsty to be transformed into wells of water. And a man born blind who's able to see and show through his seeing the blindness of the Jewish leaders all around him. And finally, Jesus raising a dead man to show his transforming power over death and to eventually transform our lowly bodies to be like his body of glory. And you see more things. So everything is transformation all through that. So there you can just see by looking at that, that everything that Jesus is doing is constantly emphasizing he has the power of transformation, which is your goal and my goal. God's goal for us is transformation. His goal is not for us to wallow in the carnality of this world and allow that to just kind of take control of us and us kind of throw our hands up and say, well, you know, what do you expect? I'm just human. I always loved that little statement when I was growing up. I don't hear it anymore, thankfully, by prayer leaders. But I there was always one guy who stood up to lead prayer, and he'd say, Lord, you know we're only human. And I always think of 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 3 through 4, where Paul said, you know, you guys are acting carnal. You're acting like mere humans. Would you just please stop it? So don't give the excuse, well, you're just human. He's transforming us. Isn't that the word Paul gave in Romans 12? In verse 1, that we're to be, verse 1 and 2, transform, not conform to this world, but transform. That power of transformation comes from him. Ephesian letter would talk about that. So John is showing it through what Jesus does. All right, so that's a little just introduction to purpose of signs. Secondly, let me give you just a bit about the uniqueness of John's presentation and how he puts that out. John is the champion of recurrent ideas. Now let's see, what other writing does John do where he does recurrent ideas? I think Patrick a few months ago talked about the first John and how I told Patrick, I said, it reminds me of a bullseye. He just starts like this and he just keeps going and going. He keeps hitting the same thing deeper and deeper until he hits just exactly what he wants. Well, that's Gospel John does a similar thing. It's just the idea of recurrent ideas here. As a matter of fact, when he starts John 1, just in these 18 verses here, or excuse me, not 18, the whole chapter, when he starts John 1, what he's going to do is he's going to show the fullness of Jesus' deity in eight titles. He's going to call him the Word, which we'll talk about a little bit today. He's going to call him the Life and the Light and the Son and the Lamb and the Messiah and the King and the Son of Man. All of those titles are going to be expanded upon in the rest of the gospel. And you say, well, what's important about those titles? Ah, that's where we need to understand that this isn't just a wow moment. John's gospel never is. It's not just a wow moment. In Colossians 1, verse 9 and 10, listen carefully to the words. This is one of the things that Paul really highlights what you would say is the main message of Colossians. So Colossians 1 verse 9, in him, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily, and you have been filled in him. All of the greatness and beauty and goodness of God dwells in him, and then you have been filled in him. Anything else you need? Mm-mm. That's why we need to stress and emphasize what he is, because he's filling us with himself. We see that in the prayer Paul gives in Ephesians 3, verse 14, down through 21, and even mentioning that we have the power to accomplish that because it's through the power that dwells within us that we can have and become in his image and be filled with him. What a different goal would that be if we kind of stop thinking so much about failure and more about this is what I need to do, this is what he's doing, he's filling me with himself. What's my next step to be filled with him? I love baseball. I played baseball all the way up till I was 55 years old or so. I love playing baseball. I still think I could go out and pitch. That's a crazy imagination I have. I know Michael's dying laughing back there. I'm going to strike you out, Michael. but you're just one of those things. You just love it. But you know, I've always thought it was interesting. In baseball, the greatest hitters of all time get out 7 out of 10 times. They fail 7 out of 10 times. These are the best of the best. Now, I say that because living the Christian life and being filled with him, we concentrate on the 7 out of 10 too much. And that's the one thing you try to teach a young boy when he starts playing baseball. Don't worry about that last out. You're always looking for the next. You'll get it. Keep swinging. And we concentrate too much in the same way. Failure. Yeah, okay. But he's filling us. You aren't filled. He's filling us. So the concentration there is seen, and that's one of his primary points here. So when you look just at the outline of the gospel, a very quick outline, you have the prologue, chapter 1, 1 through 18, as we mentioned, everything else in the gospel is going to come out of this. And then you have Jesus' public ministry, which is chapter 1, 19 through chapter 12. And then his private ministry to his own, which is going to be chapter 13 through 17. And then you're going to have the paschal climax, the Lamb of God being offered for the sins of the world in chapter 18 through 20. And then there's going to be an epilogue at the very end, and the key of the epilogue is follow me. Isn't that pretty? So he's going to first show us his public ministry, what he's doing to try to draw people to himself, then what he's doing in order to bring his disciples to be ready for his death and departure, and then his tragedy and triumph, if you will, and then the call, follow me. And that's exactly what we all obviously need to do. By the way, just passing point, whereas Matthew, Mark, and Luke all deal with Jesus' Galilean ministry, and Luke in his Perean ministry on the east side of Jordan, John's account has just brief mention now and then of him going to Galilee and coming back. Most of what he does is what he does in Jerusalem. So you can see more of the geography of it there. John, by the way, only covers about 40 days of Jesus' life. So he's snapshotting the pictures he wants. This isn't some kind of story or to be seen like Luke would, you know, a very detailed account. That's not his purpose. Finally, just three different things here on the unique structure. The word believe in all its forms used 98 times. A lot of emphasis there, isn't it? We'll talk about that in just a second. Also, the idea of life and live are used 55 times. And then the phrase, I am, ego emi. Ego emi, used 23 times in the book. Now, there's an importance of that, as I've kind of written on the screen there. Both the word ego and emi are mean I am. So either one of them could use to translate I am. John does a double emphasis. And he's doing a double emphasis to say, you need to pay attention to the fact that Jesus said, I am. And of course, there's seven times in which he connects a metaphor to the I am. And the reason being, what's that connect you to? Everybody here is going to go, oh, well, of course, right. Because you go back to Exodus chapter 3, and you remember Moses saying, who are you? Who should I say sent me? And he goes, I am. And then Jesus just steps on the scene. And in John 8, all the Pharisees are having this argument with him. And he turns around and they go, well, you're not even 50 years old. How do you know Abraham? And he says, before Abraham was, I am. Wow. And those poor guys, they didn't even know what to do with that. That was just beyond any understanding for them. All right, so thirdly, a brief mention here of logos. This is the Greek word for the word. And so I bring that up, not because I think it's important you know the Greek, but you're going to see that Greek word used a lot when you're reading commentaries or things, or somebody might mention that word. It's a very ancient word. It goes, even the Greeks use the word quite a bit to talk about the animation of power through revelation. And so it's not necessarily a new word, but Jesus is here called the Logos, the Word. And the concept of the Word is the idea, of course, revealing someone who has been hidden. Remember Moses? What was Moses? What was Moses' request for to God? I want to see your glory, right? Yeah, and God's reply was, well, if I showed you my face, you'd die. You're not going to make it. But what I'll do is I'll hide you in the cleft of the rock, and I'll pass by, and I will show you my hinder parts, as you say, and you can see a portion, and I will proclaim my name. And we'll talk a lot about that when we get on down to John 1, verse 14 through 18, because it's a direct connection there. But while Moses cannot see him, what do we see in John 1, verse 14? And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen His glory. The very thing that God told Moses, you can't do and live. Ah, he says He became flesh, and we've seen His glory. And so everything then is bringing that around to us being actually able to see God and understand Him. So the Word is revealing who God is. He's kind of like He's a mystery through the whole Old Testament. We're seeing presentations of Him. We're seeing snapshots of Him. We're seeing little things that He does. But now we're going to actually see His glory. And glory is going to be an important word in the book of John, as Jesus is going to show His glory, especially in His crucifixion. That's going to be a wow. How in the world do you show your glory in the crucifixion? An important statement that we want to see. Remember Philip in John 14. Philip said, Jesus, just show us the Father. It'd be sufficient. And he's looking at him going, I've been in your presence so long, and you haven't seen the Father? Hello? here I am. When you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And so there's very, very important connections there. And then, of course, the most important part of this is how John's gospel begins when he says, in the beginning was the Word. Now, that's so common to us that I know for myself, it is just easy to go, yeah, okay, without thinking, when's the last time I read those words? Well, Genesis 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God, and John starts with, in the beginning, the Word. In the beginning, Logos. And suddenly he's reframing us and bringing us back to understand that in the beginning, Elohim, as the Hebrew word for God is, in the beginning, Elohim, this is Jesus. He is there. He is part of this Godhead. That was a concept no Jew understood. Now, they don't understand that today. In fact, one of the fellows that I study with on Monday morning, he's been reading a lot in a Hebrew commentary, and I'd already read some of this before, but he said, you know, it's crazy. When they talk about Elohim, it's like, well, who's the plural? Who's the collective noun? Who's included there? The Father and the angels. Oh, so angels became creators? Is that what you're saying? You know, see, they just don't have that concept. And so John 1 just powers that home. Yes, in the beginning. And what an amazing statement. I think somebody here mentioned this to me a couple weeks ago. Just the amazement of thinking that the God who spoke the worlds into existence is the God who came to the earth and hung on the cross. Now, that doesn't just absolutely impact you. Isn't it so much easier to think of God just, I wouldn't go down and sacrifice like that, but I'll send somebody else to do it. No. God, who spoke the worlds into existence, came to the earth, came into the flesh. The New Revised Standard Version translates verse 3 of John 1, all things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. Everything that has been made, Jesus Christ created and made with his own word and his own voice. Now, check this out. There's a connection here to the beginning and then the Word. And what does the Word of God do? Every time you think of God speaking, what's the result? Power, isn't it? The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. When God speaks, let there be light. Light comes into existence. Everything when God's word speaks. So Jesus is the embodiment of the power of God. Look at this text in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 6. Look at the comparison. Paul says, for God who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Before God said, let there be light, what was the condition of the world? The world was without form, it was void, it was chaos. Before Jesus comes and speaks into our hearts his word, his power, his light, what were we? Without form and void and chaotic, and we needed to be brought together and created. What this says is that we, brothers and sisters, we are God's crowning creation. He didn't just speak a word and bring the universe into existence. He has now spoken a word and brought that word to the earth in order to bring us to be his crowning glory. Now, what the Ephesian letter says? Ephesians chapter 2, we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works. That word workmanship in the Greek just means his work of art. Indeed, we are his crowning glory. That's all more urging us to act like it, right? Live like it, shoot for it, be. This is the greatest pursuit that is given to anybody. A pursuit of being in the divine nature and being like him and being in his glory and being his great piece of art that shows the rulers and authorities in heavenly places God's beautiful character and manifold wisdom. That's what is really going on here. So here is the Creator who lived among us, who came as a redemptive price to bring us to himself. And you just have to ask the question, why? You know, you read all that, you go, well, why? Because God's doing what he always does, pursuing us, pursuing his creation. You see it with Israel, you see it with us. He's never going to just go, oh, well, I tried, crazy people. No, he's going to bring us to himself, and that's his point. All right, finally, let's look a little bit at John's gospel for today. Why is this so important today? I don't know for how many years I studied John, just amazed at who Jesus is, amazed at the connections and the foundations of the gospel that's there. But John brings us far beyond just the awe of who he is. You might say in some ways, so the synoptics really show some of that. But John is really showing us the idea of what it means to believe. And it is, once you really get John's message in your heart, it just absolutely is an insult and a tragedy for anybody to flash John 3:16 and just simply say, well, you know, all you got to do is believe. That is as far from John's message as one could ever read. Look again at these words in John 20, verse 31. So that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, or what's the word Christ mean? You know, some of the versions have come out with, instead of using the word Christ, Christian Standard did this for a while, and then I think they gave up on it in the last revision. But they translated Messiah instead of Christ. Do you know that's important? Christ to us just means, oh, that's just kind of his last name, like Jesus Christ or something like this. No, Jesus the Messiah. Messiah meant a lot to the Jews that doesn't mean a whole lot to us. Messiah to the Jews meant freedom. Messiah to the Jews meant rectifying all the injustices. Messiah to the Jews meant taking care of everything that humanity could not bring. And humanity had messed up. Just look at how he mentions this. You have pictures of living water to starving people. You have people fed and food that endures to everlasting life. You have a wedding feast that's nearly ruined because the wine is gone. And Jesus just goes ahead and creates 80 gallons of it for a little town in Cana. And you have a good shepherd. The idea is, when you're thinking of Messiah, when you think of Jesus as your Messiah, what we ought to be thinking is he is going to take care of everything that this world has made wrong. Everything that this world has fouled up, the Messiah comes and fixes it and brings it justice. If we had time, we'd look back to so many passages in Isaiah, but especially Isaiah 11. You can look at it yourself. He comes in righteousness and justice, and all the things that are wrong, he makes right. And that's what we should have our hope in. And it just tells us over and again not to put our trust in this world's answers, that he has everything we need. And the reason he does is because he's our Messiah. And John didn't just say, I want you to believe he's the Son of God. He said, I want you to believe he's the Messiah. And that's what the gospel keeps doing and emphasizing, showing how important it is that he is the Messiah who gives true food and true drink. And here's something else. I mentioned how that in John 20, there's an alternate reading in the Greek. And in fact, the NIV says it in the marginal reading, instead of that you may believe, that you may continue to believe. The NLT says that you may continue to believe. The NET version argues and references the possibility of that being the translation. In fact, most authorities would say it could be translated either way. So you would say, well, either John is saying that I've written this so an unbeliever can finally see who Jesus is and believe, which is the way I had kind of always taken it. Or you can read it as, I've written this for you believers so that you will continue to believe. Gospel John's written around 80 AD, midst of bad persecution that's really starting to rise up. Plus, one of the things you see in the Gospel of John that I think favors the latter translation on that is that John continues to highlight the difference between disciples, the difference between believers over and again, and those believers that are not really true believers, but fearful believers. Notice what he does. The fear of being put out of the synagogue is mentioned three times in the gospel. The first one is in the 9th chapter of the book of John. And you might remember the blind man and his parents. There's a contrast between that blind man and his parents. Verse 18, the Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son? Who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he's of age, he will speak for himself." And then John adds, "His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, 'He's of age, ask him.'" In other words, they full well knew how he got healed. And they wouldn't confess that it was Jesus. Now, you and I go, if you got kicked out of a church today, I got kicked out of this one, you'd really be sad. But you're not getting kicked out of this one. But if you, the average person get kicked out of a church, they go, they just go to another church. You get kicked out of the synagogue, your entire life just got turned upside down. You can't buy, you can't sell, you can't work, you can't eat, you can't have a relationship. You're done. You might as well move to a place where there's only Romans and hope for the best. It was devastating. You'd be like kicked out of your family and no inheritance and no nothing. Yes, they were scared. And reasonably so. To be frightened, to be cast out of the synagogue. The earth beast in Revelation 13. Here's what the earth beast does. This reflects this kicked out of the synagogue. Quote, "Also it," the earth beast, "causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand and the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of his name." You get a little idea? You don't submit to what we're telling you and the way you're supposed to believe, and we're telling you how to believe, and we're telling you how to act, you don't submit to it, you're not going to be able to buy or sell or anything, and you're going to be absolutely ostracized. Now, fortunately, that never happened to us, right? It's already happening. It is already happening. You remember when Obamacare came in? You know, shrug your shoulders. I needed it. I didn't need it. Whatever. It doesn't matter. But there was one part of it that a lot of people didn't notice. If you were a Florida college or a Hobby Lobby, you had to ask for an exemption so that you could have a right not to offer abortion insurance to your employees. Florida College immediately sent to the president a request for an exemption. For 8 years, they never got the exemption across their desk. They were in violation of the law. President Trump came in, and within 1 month, without even a request, he sent the exemption across their desk. Now, President Biden, kind of Catholic, maybe he won't follow up on that, but there's already rumblings about what if a Christian college, quote unquote, decides that, we can't accept somebody, a student, who would be LGBT, etc., practicing. Oh, really? Well, you are violating the law. Well, we don't accept government money anyway. That's okay, but your students do. And you know what? Student loans are in total control of the government now. So now, maybe the government could do this, and there's been threats. Oh, well, if a college won't accept these certain immoral practices, then here's what's going to happen. The college will lose its accreditation. Students who go to the college will not be able to get loans, and the college is going to die. And if you do get a degree at that college, the corporate world's not going to accept the degree. It's invalid. Sound like not being able to buy and sell, etc.? Just recently, military leaders were fired for not accepting critical race theory, which is as biblically sinful as it can get, and hateful. Corporations firing people who did not accept the LGBTQ, etc. Mantra. You have in California, churches have been fined thousands upon thousands of dollars because they met anyway. In Calgary, Canada, different pastors have been arrested. One particular pastor was arrested on a freeway. They got his license plate number and drug him out of his car in the presence of his children and wife, who were in tears, cuffed him and drug him into a car and put him in high security, not minimum security, maximum security prison for 35 days to punish him because they secretly meeting in barns and moving around barns. They had helicopters trying to find them. Now you get fret. Now what happens when that happens? Who's going to cave? Who's going to have fear? You see, we're closer to getting cast out of the synagogue than what we ever think. And all it takes is just for somebody in power. Nowadays, you don't have to vote it in. You've probably noticed that for the last 3 or 4 administrations. You don't have to vote it in. The Congress has nothing to do with it. The president can just say, that's what we're doing. So we live closer and closer to more of that. You know, I don't try to get political. That ain't political. That's just saying get ready mentally for how we will respond. Always in peace, always gentleness, always in love, always reasoning, but never caving to anything that would be a violation of God's law. And that's why the Gospel of John is so relevant. You have again John chapter 12. Look at the words there. In John 12, you have, here's some of the authorities. Verse 42, nevertheless, even many of the authorities believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it so they would not be put out of the synagogue. For they love the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. Some of the things happened during this virus expose some of this. You need to be careful. In John 16, last words to the disciples. In John 16, verse 1, Jesus says, I have said all these things to you to keep you from falling away. There's a purpose, isn't it? There is a purpose statement to keep you from falling away. Why? Because they will put you out of the synagogues. Indeed, the hour is coming when whoever kills you will think he is offering service to God. Yes, that's exactly right. And there is a stark difference given over and over again throughout this gospel of those who say they're believers and are not, or not full believers, who will not go all the way. So the question always before us is, whose glory are we looking for? Are we going to seek the glory that comes from God or the glory that comes from men? That's the question. Great gospel. I look forward to seeing some of these great messages that will be given in this gospel account. If you're not a Christian, we urge you to consider your condition. If you know what you need to do to be saved, and you understand that you have to come to Him, give your life completely to Him, be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins. You can do that right now while together we stand and while we sing.